Interview with John Lifton, February 19th, 2009, in New York City, by Kenneth Durr.
Well, I want to start with some background and sort of back into your getting into the SEC. Your education, where'd you go to law school?
Columbia.
Okay. Did you study securities law?
Actually, I didn't. There weren't many courses available at the time, and the one that was available didn't fit my schedule, so I did not.
Were you interested at that point?
I became interested probably my third year of law school and decided that if I could, I wanted to work for a law firm that did securities work, which is what happened.
What was interesting about it?
Well, I had a tough decision whether to go to business school or law school. I'd always had some quantitative interests, and it seemed to me that from the little I knew about it, securities might be a way to combine the interest in numbers and quantitative concepts with the legal background I had acquired.
Well, the big question for me is how Bill Casey found you.
Well, my first job was at Sullivan & Cromwell out of law school. So I worked there for 4 years doing securities and corporate work. And as I got well into my fourth year, starting to get a little bored, things started to look the same. I was interested in doing something else, but just on an experimental basis, I wasn't sure I wanted to really cut my ties with the firm because I had really learned a lot there and liked it. One day I was in an internal elevator with one of my colleagues, and I heard him say to a third person that he had just had a trip to Washington to interview with then-chairman Bill Casey. And when the other person got off the elevator, I said, "What was that all about?" And he said, "Oh, well, I'm interviewing to be Casey's executive assistant, but I'm not sure whether I'm going to do it or not." And I said, "Well, if you decide not to do it, could you let me know?" And the next day or two, he called me and said, "You know, I don't think I'm going to do it. My wife doesn't want to move to Washington." And I said, "Do you mind if I follow up on it?" And he said, "Not at all." So I went to the senior partner of the firm and told him my interest, and he said, "Well, we'd like you to stay, but if you're really dead set on doing it, we'll try to be of help." And I said I was interested. And he was, I suppose, actually the head of the corporate group. He went to Arthur Dean, who was the senior partner of the firm, who called Bill Casey and said that although the other associate wasn't ready to come, they had someone else to recommend. I got a call from Casey's office to come down for an interview within a few days, as I recall. And I went down there, met with him for an hour or so, and he started talking as though I had the job without much checking. And I seem to remember it just went very quickly after that.
What kinds of things was he talking about?
He wanted somebody, although the job I had thought I applied for was an executive assistance job, which was kind of a general chief of staff type of role. He wanted somebody to help with what was then going on in reforming the equity markets. There were a lot of issues swirling around about this role of the New York Stock Exchange and its competitors and what sort of views what role the commission should have in sorting out that whole process. And he wanted someone to look after those issues for him primarily. And I told him that, you know, I didn't really have a lot of trading experience. My experience was mostly on the financing and transactional side. And, you know, Casey, in his kind of gruff way, said, "Well, you'll figure it out." And he asked me to take over responsibility for that. And I came down in August of 1971, and I took over the office that had been inhabited by Max Baucus, who's now a senator from Montana, who was just on his way out. He had been executive assistant to the previous chairman, Hamer Budge, and had some interesting chats with Max about what it was like there. But Hamer Budge had been kind of out of his element and was sort of getting a lot of pressure from all sides. And I think Baucus was glad to be leaving, too.
Did he tell you some more stories about that?
He told me a few. I don't remember them at this point. He told me he was going to go back to Montana and get into politics, which he did, which he certainly did. And, you know, Casey hired a fairly large staff for the chairman's office, as you probably know. He had Sandy Whitman as his executive assistant, and then he had four special counsels, ultimately, to deal with different things. In addition to myself, it was Lee Picard and Howard Crystal, a guy, I think his name was Jim Lynch. But I had, my bailiwick was primarily equity markets, which was, as I said, very, very topical.
Yeah, can we pursue that a little more? What were the big issues there with the equity markets, and what were driving them?
Well, there were two big issues. One of them was what were known as fixed commission rates, you know, whether the stock exchange should continue to set what they called maximum rates, but which really served as minimum rates that all the brokerage firms could charge. And brokerage firms acting through the stock exchange, which in that role was a bit of a trade association, was trying to maintain the rate structure because it was extraordinarily profitable for them as institutions had become a bigger factor in trading stocks, which had not always been the case. You know, the whatever discounts were built into the commission structure certainly did not take account of the huge economies of scale. In other words, certainly didn't take as much effort to, or rather didn't take, you know, 100 times as much effort to execute a 10,000 share order as a 100 share order. So most of the firms were vying for institutional business because of the huge profitability, and were offering all kinds of services for free to, in order to attract business from the institutional buyers, you know, the mutual funds and insurance companies and other institutional investors. It was almost like the airlines in the days before deregulation. And, you know, the commission understood that that was kind of uneconomic and that there was a lot of pressure from the institutional community and from the, I think, those on the staff with an economics bent to say, let's remove the fixed commission rates, let's open it up to competition. And the brokerage firms and the stock exchange were fighting that bitterly, and that was a fight that had gone on for a number of years, basically from the late 60s up until 1975, when the legislation finally was enacted that eliminated fixed rates. So that was one of the big issues, and it was purely economics. There wasn't really any regulatory issue there at all.
It was the SEC listening to the institutional investors?
The SEC was listening to everybody, but, you know, that to the extent that the staff was siding with anybody, it was really the institutions that... It seemed to me at that time that the institutions were probably the most vocal constituency and really had the ear of the staff. You know, of course, small investors, too. I'm not excluding them, but they weren't really part of this battle. It was really between the brokerage firms and the institutions. And I think the staff was tilting towards the institutions. But, you know, on the other side, the stock exchange was saying, if you eliminate fixed rates and you drive down the price of brokerage commissions, that'll be the end of research because it'll no longer make sense for brokerage firms to produce research because the institutions won't be able to pay for it. They'll be compelled to always get the lowest possible commission rates, and no one will pay cash for research. You know, and that produced its own set of arguments, which go on to this day, by the way. But, you know, from a kind of a political point of view, the commissioners were hearing that, on the one hand, I mean, they saw the economic arguments were obvious, but, you know, they were also afraid to make such a massive change that would at least run the risk of completely upending the whole brokerage services industry, the financial services industry at that time, because brokerage was a much bigger part of it than it is today. Investment banking was a relatively small part, as was trading. So the commission was really afraid of changing the economics of the business. And, you know, in retrospect, it really did change the economics. That and a number of other things changed the economics drastically. And, you know, many institutional firms merged with retail firms over the next 10 years, kind of as predicted, but research didn't go away.
Well, unfixing rates, the issue of commission rates is a big one. One of the things that you spent a lot of time on was the idea of a central market, the idea
correct.
Of the markets together. Where did the impetus for that come from?
I kind of see that as a distinct issue from rates. You know, again, it was an economist's argument that the New York Stock Exchange is a monopoly or quasi-monopoly, that there's very little trading that's permitted away from the exchange in the stocks that they have listed, which is, you know, was all the big stocks, the most popular stocks, the most heavily traded. There weren't stocks like Microsoft that wanted to be over the counter. Almost every single large cap stock was on the stock exchange, and there were a variety of rules that prevented members of the stock exchange from trading in those stocks anywhere but on the exchange. And the exchange's argument was, we are the natural monopoly, or like a utility, and it makes the most sense for all the orders to come to us. That'll maximize the interaction of bids and offers, and large and small investors will all benefit by getting the best price. And, you know, within its own logical construct, it made sense, except it excluded any competition. And the commission was always seduced by the idea that there really should be some competition, because the stock exchange did so many things to enrich itself that it seemed like it just had to be some other counterweight. So the commission encouraged the growth of the regional stock exchanges, which provided some almost, you might say, parasitic competition, in that, you know, they only were able to get the crumbs that, for whatever reason, were not available to the stock exchange, to the New York Stock Exchange, because of time of day or regional brokers or regional stocks or some other reason, almost an excuse to trade off the exchange. So that was one counterweight. And the other was called the third market, which was an over-the-counter market in listed stocks that a few dealers maintained. And one of the commission's pet projects was to adopt a rule that made it possible for members of the stock exchange to take orders in listed stocks off the exchange and execute them in the third market.
Did this happen while you were there?
I'm pretty sure it did. I know it was very, very actively debated while I was there. I'm trying to remember the number of the rule. It was 19B. I think, was it 19B or... That sticks in my mind, but I should have gone back and reviewed it, and I didn't.
Well, the other thing is, okay, you talked about all these things that were in the air, so to speak. How much of this was Bill Casey and something that he was interested in accomplishing?
Well, Bill Casey understood the economic arguments, and I think he had a streak in him of wanting to do what really made sense. On the other hand, he also was a former politician and was a political guy and was thought to have had relatively close ties to folks in the White House. Probably, I think he did. And you know, so the fact there were certain scandals that came close to touching the SEC during his tenure, but nothing like the Brad Cook era. So he was also sensitive to the complaints of the stock exchange and their membership, because they were, you know, they had political connections too, and of course they were using those. And you know, I don't know what conversations he had with people at the White House or on the White House staff, but he was cautious. So in other words, it wasn't that he was pushing for these reforms, but by no means, I would say, was he opposed to them. And it was almost as though he kept going back and forth. It sort of felt like whoever talked to him last, he seemed to agree with on many controversial issues like this. You know, he'd understand the logic of the national market system, for example, and he supported, because he was a bit of a visionary, and he supported the idea of the national market system, and he, you know, encouraged the staff to write a blueprint. And in fact, you know, while I was there, we put out two, what he called, white papers endorsing the notion of a national market system. We called it a central market system at the time. I think it was in 72 and 73.
Right.
And, you know, some of the arguments I think you might see in those documents, you know, have been around for decades. And, you know, it's probably only the last few years that they've actually been given the force of law, you know, requiring brokers to behave as though there is one single auction going on for stocks. It's always been controversial, but you know, I think in the end, Bill Casey came down on the side of the reforms. You know, he ultimately was dragged along in favor of eliminating fixed rates because it made sense.
Well, you would know because he brought you in to work on these issues, certainly in the central market.
Yeah, but you know, he talked to a lot of people. I mean, he talked to his staff. You know, I was, you know, 29 years old at the time. I mean, you know, he wasn't going to take my word for everything. But, you know, he would talk about what he thought, and it was clear that he understood all the arguments. Very, very bright man. But
well, let's wade into that a little bit. You came in, and your job is essentially to oversee a lot of these efforts having to do, especially, I guess, with the central market, the idea of the central market. And one of the earliest things were some hearings. Do you recall getting those hearings in place and conducting them? Was that something that you were responsible for?
Yes. I was the... what he did is he set up three advisory committees. One was to create a consolidated reporting system, like a consolidated tape, it was called. One was to create a central market system, and I've forgotten for the moment what the third one was. Do you know?
Disclosure.
I think that was the consolidated tape.
Okay. Yeah, the integration of the markets.
Integration of the markets was the central market
was
system.
It was just basic looking at the central
markets. I probably have some data to fill that out. But anyway, I was the secretary of all three of these committees. The chairman of the committee on the central market system was Alan Greenspan. You probably know that, right?
I noticed the name.
Yeah. And, you know, he approached it as an economist, of course, and you know, thought it made a lot of sense. But there were a lot of industry people on the committee. And so there was, on all these committees, it was a balancing of, you know, academics, institutional representatives, people from the securities industry, and regulators. Well, not, let's see, were there regulators? No, I guess there weren't really any regulators involved. So it was just industry folks and some academics. And so there was a, you know, a kind of a tug of war over these issues and what came out, although I think, you know, in a way they were progressive at the time, you know, were very compromised points of view.
You say tug of war. Was it generally the industry versus the academics?
No, it was the brokers versus the institutions. It was all about money.
So did you feel like that system worked well, that you were able to reach practical positions that could be implemented that way?
Well, these committees did what would have had to have been done in later years through public hearings, but they preceded the Government and Sunshine Act, so it was still possible for the commission and other government agencies to establish these committees and let them operate in private. And I think that you know, they were beneficial to government in many respects because people said what they really thought and the views got on the table and the compromises got struck. So I think the answer is, yeah, they were beneficial. It was a good way of fact-finding, basically, for, you know, so the staff and the commissioners could really understand what the issues were. All points of view could be aired in a fairly candid forum.
One thing I'm looking at is, you mentioned that there were two white papers. The first is a thing called the Future Structures Statement,
right,
which is early 72. And then
yes.
The white paper is in 73.
Correct.
It's after this advisory committee process. I want to get a sense of what distinguished the two. What was the difference between the Future Structures Statement and the white paper?
Oh, boy. I'd really have to go read them, but I did write both initial drafts of both of them, and I seem to remember that the first one was more about getting down the principles, and the second one was more about trying to suggest practical steps that could be taken to begin to put the system together.
Okay. Which would make sense. Did these advisory committees have the Future Structure Statement to sort of chew over?
Yes, I believe they did.
Okay. So it was sort of elaborating on that and seeing what might work.
But remember, only one of the committees was really focused on that particular subject. It may be the third one was on commission rates. I apologize for not being able to remember that, but perhaps I can supply it.
Yeah, I've actually got that. It's just that my code is not.
Oh, I see. Okay.
All right. You or me an indication of what that.
Do you have the other chairman's names? The chairs of the committees?
Yeah, I do.
In addition to Green. Oh, okay. That might help me.
Alan Greenspan was memorable, I guess.
Yeah.
Working with him. Anybody else in there that you were particularly pleased to work with?
Well, there was a guy named Sandy Lewis, who you really should talk to. And he's a unique individual, who at the time was a risk arbitrageur. Sandy's still alive, still extremely interested in issues, and we'll talk with you for at least 12 hours if you give him a chance. But he did work on the staff. He worked for Rod Hills. So if you have an excuse to do it, I think you'll find it very interesting. But he was on the disclosure committee, I think, and Sandy was the kind of guy who put his view of principle above everything else, above making money, and just lectured everybody about how they should be good citizens and do the right thing. And, you know, I formed a lifelong relationship with him as a result of that, just because he was such an interesting, larger-than-life character. Who else? Oh, gosh. I don't know if there were any others, but, you know, it was certainly a good opportunity for me to get to know a lot of the the key players in the industry. And, you know, it was really an extraordinary thing at that point in one's career to get to meet all these senior players and, you know, see how they thought and, you know, just watch them behave.
It must have given you a sense of perspective, I guess, that you didn't have.
Indeed, it did. I mean, I learned about the equity markets, which I hadn't experienced in my limited legal practice. And, you know, for a long time after that, you know, I became part of this fairly limited group of people who understood market regulation as it related to the equity trading markets. So it was, you know, very a unique experience from that point of view. But, you know, just all the people who came into the commission, you know, to plead their case. I mean, one of them was Mike Bloomberg, you know, who was at the time, I think, worked for the institutional trading department of Salomon Brothers. And he came in with the general counsel of Salomon Brothers, Don Feuerstein, to talk about an information system he was building for Salomon Brothers to help their traders keep track of what positions the various institutions had in stock so that Salomon could trade them better. And they just, I think they were making a pitch for us to support their efforts, I guess. I can't remember what their specific issue was. Maybe it was just, you know, a get acquainted type of meeting. But they did talk a lot about the information system that he was working on, which he obviously continued to work on after he left Salomon Brothers.
What else was on your plate while you were an assistant to the chairman?
Oh, gosh. I guess the 75 Act amendments started to be drafted in, I think, 73. And it was I'm trying to remember the name of the guy. He's sort of he's the dean of the house, the guy from Michigan, John. The guy who represents the auto industry, basically.
John Dingell.
Yeah, Dingell was the head of the Interstate Commerce, I think, at the time, and so he was the lead on the House side, and on the Senate side it had been Williams, but then I think Williams might have had his political problems, and I'm trying to remember who the senator was who was pushing all this. But in any event, yeah, the Hill was very interested in changing the rules of the game and asked the commission to try to put its blueprint for a national market system into legislative language. And, you know, they had these two principal goals of mandating at least the outline of a national market system and also eliminating fixed commission rates, which the 75 Act amendments did. And it also set up other things like regulation of transfer agents and regulation of it might have been the beginning of municipal bond regulation around that time, and, you know, some other things on the periphery. But I mean, I think the centerpiece of that legislation was the two things that I just mentioned. You know, since they were my projects, I spent a lot of time working on that legislation, along with Harvey Pitt, who was the general counsel to the Division of Market Regulation.
Now, were you ever formally in the Division of Market Regulation?
Right. I started as Casey's special counsel. And then he reorganized the commission while I was there and, you know, basically consolidated all the enforcement arms into a new division of enforcement and converted trading and markets to market regulation. And he had originally told me that he would make me the director of that division. He called me just the day before he did it. I think I was in Chicago at the time and said, you know, I think I'm going to have to make Brad Cook the director. You'll be associate director for market structure. And Cook is probably going to be the next chairman, and he's agreed to make you the director. So I said, fine. So I was in the division for, I can't remember, it was 1 or 2 years, but about roughly half the time I was there. And, you know, was responsible at a staff level for pushing a lot of these things forward. You know, I seem to remember I had something like, I don't know, 30 or 40 memos that went to the, memos of recommendation that went to the commission. And in those days, there were no dissents. You know, everything that Casey wanted to go went through without dissent. You know, the commission was not particularly inclined to pick fights in those days. It wasn't very political.
Was it the kind of thing where if there was a dissent, it would have been ironed out in advance?
I think so. I mean, you know, I think there were a lot of conversations between commissioners. Today, you know, under the Sunshine Rules, it's, you know, commissioners can't get together in private, so it makes it a lot harder for that to happen. But that's probably why it was.
Well, when Brad Cook came in, then was his agenda just basically, let's continue the things we've been doing under this other structure? Or did he or Chairman Casey or you working with him have some other ideas as to what you wanted to see market?
His agenda wasn't perceptibly different from Casey's. I think that he, you know, was a little more, felt himself a little more beholden to the political interests, you know, as we later found out, and so was maybe a little slower moving, less bold in, you know, pushing for the legislation and the other initiatives that were going on at the time.
Market regulation was a brand new division. Was it seen that way?
No, it really was. It was the continuation of the old trading and markets division, but without the enforcement arm.
Okay, and that's the way it was understood, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, there were four groups that looked after different things. One looked after the net capital rule, market structure. I can't remember what the other two were, but you know, it was basically the same people doing the same things. For the most part, you know, with some of Casey's staff people moved down, you know, into the main staff of the commission.
You talked earlier about unfixing commission rates, and there was some movement on that under Casey and Brad Cook.
Right, and ultimately culminating in the amendment, the securities,
right.
The 75 amendments, which you know, promulgated a specific date, May 1 of, must have been 76, I think it was, that, you know, after that date, fixed rates were eliminated. Part of preparing for it was drafting Section 28E of the 34 Act, which attempted to provide a safe harbor so that this argument about, you know, people, institutions being unable to pay higher commissions for full service, including research, you know, wouldn't drive out research. And 28E has been hotly debated and interpreted for 30 years.
There was something that they called prudent gradualism, do you remember that? Where the idea was transactions over a certain
I remember the phrase, and I also remember the phenomenon. I didn't remember that they were referring to the same thing, but I think what you're saying is that the stock exchange had adopted a policy of discounting rates for the larger orders, and it may be, this is, I don't remember for sure, that on the really large orders they had eliminated minimums. That may be what it refers to.
Who were the people that you were working with and you were relying on?
Within the commission?
And without.
Well, I worked closely with Harvey Pitt, particularly when he was counsel to general, or I guess it was called counsel to the division. Before I went down to the division, when I was in Casey's office, I worked closely with Sandy Whitman, who, you talked to Sandy yet? Who was Casey's executive assistant. And to some extent with Lee Picard, who was more involved in broker-dealer regulation, you know, capital rules, that sort of thing, I think. It seemed like he had a more of a back office orientation. So that was Casey's staff. The commissioners, I think we worked too close. I don't think I worked too closely with any of the other commissioners. The other division directors was Alan Levinson and Alan Mostoff. General counsel was, I think it was, who was it? I guess it was Cook during most of the time. I'm not sure who it was after Cook, but I worked with them a bit. A guy named Michael Saperstein, who was in market regulation, he was very political, and he saw it, his role as being the representative of the White House at the commission, and he was keeping an eye on the staff to make sure they didn't stray too far from what he perceived the White House wanted to happen. But, you know, people kind of humored him. I mean, he was a smart guy, and he wasn't a fool, but he's still around. I think until recently, he was at Bear Stearns. Let's see, outside the industry, outside the commission, in the industry, there were some staffers on the Hill who we spent a fair amount of time with. Remember Al Harris was on the Senate staff. Can't remember the people on the House staff. I don't know. I guess you're.
You talked about you were really looking at market structure. I guess that's what you were doing. And you talked about Lee Picard working in sort of back office type issues. Was that a traditional division of labor? Is that the way market reg was set up?
No, I think market structure was a new office. That was the new part. But the other stuff, I think, had already been, you know, a part of the old trading and markets division.
Okay.
Shelley Rappaport was a key player on those issues within the division. Bob Lewis, who ultimately became director. Andy Klein, who was my senior deputy, ultimately became director. Roger Blanc.
What were some of the other issues that you worked on in addition to?
Well, you asked me that, and I'm trying to remember. I mean, it almost seems like everything came back to those issues in one way or another. You know, there were a lot of sub-issues like, you know, consolidated quotation system and,
right,
you know, the consolidated tape itself and, you know, how we're going to protect research.
He had something called the composite tape.
Yeah. that was one of the things I just mentioned. You know, that's the ticker tape. But so that instead of there just being one tape that showed the New York Stock Exchange's prices, we as a product of this advisory committee I mentioned, adopted a rule, I think it was 17A15 or something like that, that that may not be right, that mandated a composite tape so that the stock exchange tape had to include trade reports from the regional exchanges in the third market as well.
When you get something that's going to be doing that, is it really going to be a tape? Is that the way you were envisioning it?
Well, it was a tape. It was a tape, but it also, you know, in the sense that, you know, there still is a ticker, you know, that reports trades, and for many years, you know, there was a little symbol that showed what market it was coming from if it wasn't from New York. And that was very controversial. And I'm not sure if it was then or later that, you know, the trade reports that you see in the newspapers, you know, there used to be these long tables of stock prices. I mean, they still exist. At some point, they became not just the New York Stock Exchange highs and lows and closing prices, but national market closing prices. So, you know, wherever the high was hit, wherever the close was, the last trade was, you know, it would be reported. So it was a kind of a expansion, you know, as a first step towards the national market system. And then, you know, trying to build a quotation system was another way of trying to develop a national market system. You know, the ultimate goal of the national market system was what, you know, people refer to as a consolidated limit order book, so that all orders would flow into a single system. And there were debates about whether that was a good idea, and then even if you had such a system, whether you would require all brokers to honor the best quote in the system, you know, whether they had to sell or they have to sell to whatever market was displaying the highest bid. And that rule, which only got adopted a few years ago, was called a hard clob rule. You probably heard about that. And very controversial, because there are lots of arguments back and forth about what...
That raises the issue of technology. I mean, this is... We're talking about 1971, 72. This is pretty early on. You know, people still have big mainframe computers, and there's not the nimbleness of information processing.
Right. I mean, there was really no concept of personal computers then. But still, it was obvious to everybody, I would say, that the idea of linking the markets electronically was not going to be hard. You know, we had the technology then to do it. Probably couldn't have done it as quickly as we could do it today. But, you know, the system that was envisioned in the early 70s is not that different from the system that was finally mandated, you know, in around 2004, 2005. Which is interesting when you think back. It took 35 years to get it implemented. But the technological model didn't really change that much.
Which, that really confounds the way I thought about it, because I always assumed, well, it's a great idea, but the technology had to catch up.
It wasn't the technology. It was the politics and the economic interests behind the politics. Absolutely. No one ever made an effective argument that that the technology didn't exist.
How influential, at this point you've got some of the electronic trading. NASDAQ is just coming up.
Yeah, NASDAQ started around 72, I think.
Were you looking at these things closely and trying to figure out what you could learn from them?
Yes, I mean, NASDAQ was a kind of a model, you know, sort of a simple model of what a national market system could look like. And NASDAQ was not a hard club. I mean, NASDAQ did consolidate quotes. It didn't mandate it had no mandatory rules about execution. There were, of course, best execution obligations that were part of a broker's duty, you know, to get the best price for the customer. So in a way, but NASDAQ kind of bridged the gap. I mean, it presented its quotes in such a way that it still gave the broker some flexibility to honor relationships and other obligations that he might have. It didn't quite array it in a way that made it mandatory that you execute against the best bid or the best offer.
Right.
But it was definitely a big step in the direction that we were heading.
It took the trading off the floor.
Well, that trading, the trading that NASDAQ supported was never done on the floor. That was always over the counter. But it automated that, or took a big step towards automating that by making the quotes visible. It's kind of like, you know, putting them online. You know what I mean? It was the closest thing that anybody had to being able to shop on your PC as opposed to the telephone. That was the kind of step forward that NASDAQ was.
Oh, you had when you came out with the composite tape, and this would have been the white paper in 73, and you described the process of going through with these committees and preparing this thing. What was the reception when you put this out? Was there a great deal of interest? Was there a great deal of concern?
Well, the stock exchange fought the idea of the consolidated tape for a long time. But when the rule finally came out, you know, then it became a fight over revenues from the tape. The other parties who contributed quotes to the tape wanted to share in the revenues, which were an important source. Market data has always been an important source of stock exchange income. Something like 25, well, in the old days it was 25%, roughly. And, you know, by the time the rule was enacted, the furor over whether we should have it or not had died down, and it shifted to different arenas, like how revenues would be shared, what sort of identifiers would be put on the prices, sort of subsidiary issues. But, you know, was it seen as a real breakthrough? I don't know. I mean, it seemed like one to the staff, but, you know, it was probably one day's worth of newspaper stories, and that was it.
I guess, did you expect something to happen, maybe to move forward?
Yeah, we thought it might trigger other activity and other movement towards the stock, towards the central market system, but it turned out that every step forward had to be mandated. Nothing seemed to be happening naturally.
Did you stay on? Were you in the commission when Ray Garrett came in?
Yes.
For how long?
Do you remember when he started?
73.
Yeah, that's sort of my recollection. I think for about another year.
Still working on this national market system.
Yeah, probably less than a year in the end. And I seem to remember he came on in the summer of 73, and I think I left in April of 74. And, you know, I had been used to working directly with Casey and then directly with Cook. And because of something that we don't really need to go into, Lee Picard became director rather than me, and so when Ray came in, you know, he naturally would go to Lee to ask about market structure issues, and Lee would come down and ask me to brief him. You know, that I got kind of tired of that quickly and started looking around for something else to do.
So market structure remained an important issue for Garrett.
I think so, but I think that it was, actually, that was when I left in April of 74. The final push for the 75 amendments was going on. You know, the political machinations were going on, and Ray was certainly supportive of it. I don't know how intimately familiar he was with all the details of it, but you know, he certainly supported it, and that happened during his tenure, as I recall.
The commission went through three chairmen relatively quickly because of what happened with Brad Cook mostly. But could that have had anything to do with the fact that these market structure initiatives got bogged down a little bit? That there were three different people at the helm?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think there was ever. I don't recall there being any real policy changes other than what I mentioned to you about Cook's reluctance to stand up to the stock exchange. I mean, he later admitted to me a while after he left the commission that he was getting very frequent calls from senior people at the stock exchange about things that they were worried about that were going on. You know, so I mean, I think he probably slowed things down a bit, but I don't think he felt that he was in a position to really stop them. He told me that was related to you know, my not being appointed director. That they were afraid that, you know, I was pushing too hard on the national market system.
Were they more hospitable or more willing to think about the idea of unfixing rates than they were about the national markets?
No, but I think they just realized that the boat had sailed on that one, and you know, they were just going to try to get the best deal they could, which probably meant 28E, you know, some sort of a safe harbor. But I think they realized, I mean, that had been going on for a very long time, and they were clearly losing that battle. You know, there was really no good economic argument, and the opposition just began to lose steam, I think.
Okay, but they still had a lot more ground to stand on when it came to the national market system.
Yeah, because orders were still going to flow to the New York Stock Exchange. There was still a tremendous amount of money to be made on small orders. You know, this is decades before decimalization, so you know, the minimum quote was an eighth, and actually, you know, people on the floor could make an extremely good living just trading all day back and forth, you know, for very small incremental differences. When it got down to pennies, it became a lot tougher on the floor people, the specialists and the $2 brokers. But in those days, they could still make a tremendous amount of money, even with you know, it was really the upstairs brokers who had the most to lose from the end of fixed rates.
Well, you had gotten this very detailed education about market structure that you never thought you were going to have, I guess, when you were thinking about going into the SEC. How did that play itself out later on? Did you, after you left the SEC, were you looking to capitalize on that expertise, or were you looking for something different?
I wanted to use the expertise. I went to into law practice. I joined a firm called Rogers and Wells in Washington, and you know, some of my clients came to me for that expertise. Merrill Lynch was one. Cincinnati Stock Exchange was another. You know, subsequently, brokerage firms began hiring more lawyers in-house from the commission, so they, you know, had less and less of a need for for outside counsel for those areas. But you know, I was one of a handful of lawyers who was thought to know something about market structure issues.
What kinds of problems or challenges would you handle for your clients?
Well, for the Cincinnati Stock Exchange, for example, I seem to remember negotiating against the New York Stock Exchange when they were joining something called the it was some sort of a consolidated reporting system that existed up until fairly recently, and it was the contractual part of combining all the different market centers into this reporting system. And I think it also covered the revenue sharing, and the stock exchange negotiated from a position of great strength, and it was very frustrating. But that's an example of, you know, representing them in their dealings to become players in the consolidated universe. For Merrill Lynch, it was more, this fellow Sandy Lewis, whom I mentioned to you, had gone to work for Merrill, and he had Don Regan's ear. Don Regan was then the CEO of Merrill, and he persuaded Regan to adopt some of the more progressive views on market structure, and so advising them on policy statements and testimony and the sort of positioning that Merrill was doing for its own as a firm in the industry, advising them on that. And then, you know, a lot of just trading questions about, you know, does this rule prohibit this kind of a trade? That sort of thing. Short sale rule. Consolidated tape rules. Do you have to do this? Do you have to do that? You know, just interpreting the rules. The kind of mundane stuff that lawyers do day in, day out. But I was sort of answering more on the big issues that flowed from it. And then, you know, after about 11 years of practice, I went into the industry working for a small bond trading firm. It was also a what we would today call a private equity firm. And I think it was, you know, in a way the commission role that led me to that. But after that, I went to Kidder Peabody, which was a big investment bank at the time, as general counsel. I think my SEC background was an important part of getting that job. I think every job I've had since then, the SEC background has been important.
You know, other than just knowing the nuts and bolts.
You know, when you come from the commission, you come with a reputation of understanding how the regulators think, being connected, although, you know, in reality that doesn't mean that much. But, you know, there is a sort of a relationship you continue to have for decades after you leave with people who are still there. I mean, I still know people on the staff to this day. And, you know, sort of an imprimatur of someone who would want to do things the right way. And so that happened to the institutions I worked for, the three after that, all had had problems with the government. And they wanted to bring in someone who, you know, could help them clean up the problems, and having a commission, an SEC background in your resume seemed desirable. It was helpful from that point of view.
At one point, I found reference to you serving as a chair on a committee on federal regulation of securities.
Yeah, American Bar Association.
Yeah, okay. And is that a standing committee that's always?
Yes. Yeah.
What was that project in particular that you were?
Well, no, that's a committee that has, you know, gone on as long as I've been in practice. You know, probably goes back 50 years, and it comments on its principal role. It's got something like 2,000 members. I mean, it's a huge membership, and it's mostly private practitioners and a few in-house lawyers from all over the country, and it comments on all SEC or almost all SEC rule proposals, and its views are taken pretty seriously by the staff. I mean, the comments are extremely well thought out and written. And, you know, the committee tries to focus on the legal problems as opposed to taking a policy view. Almost never takes a policy view. And it was a great experience. The real irony in my career was that twice I served on the New York Stock Exchange Legal Advisory Committee, which I just thought was extremely ironic given the contentiousness, you know, between my role as a staffer and the stock exchange.
Yeah, the fact that they were concerned about your influence at one point.
Yeah, I think the words they used was dangerous radical.
Well, is there anything else that we should talk about that we haven't touched on?
I mean, no. I mean, I have some thoughts, of course, about what's gone on recently, but I don't think that's relevant to the historical project. I think the commission will get its reputation back, as it certainly deserves to. And, you know, I continue to have immense respect for it as an agency, you know, and the people that works who work there. I mean, I thought it was, you know, one of the best possible professional experiences that anybody could have. And, you know, just working for people who were so capable and so dedicated to the public interest, you know, 95% of them at least, thought of nothing else. You know, the political part was such a small part of it, and only, you know, a few people at the very top who felt they had a little bit of a political role. It was generally, a very good example of the classic independent regulatory agency at work. And, you know, it took a long time to get some things done, but I think the commission has always been a pretty well-balanced agency. You never got really captured by a particular point of view, by the industry, by the government, you know, by any particular administration. You know, it's always had to, you know, trim its sails a little bit from time to time. Depending on who was in the White House and who was in power on the Hill, and, you know, whether they felt like using the commission to express their frustrations or not. But they always managed to stay above the political fray, I think, in a very professional way that not all agencies have been able to do.
Yeah. And with a little luck, it'll continue to do that.
I hope so.
All right. Well, thank you.